All right, we pick up in 1811. The critical change that's come to the Covenant or church at this point is that they're now American. There's something of what it means to be American that now comes to have prominence, influence in the Covenanter church. The Scottish Covenanters, defined by their unique folkways, pictured in their unique folkways, have immigrated. And in that season of change, that season of immigration, other folkways joined with the old. The old faded, the old changed, new ones came and were born. Last of all, their folkways lived on. And in the American Covenanters, we will see these folkways then ebb and flow with uniquely American challenges. Okay? So I'm going to organize around that idea. The uniquely American challenges or situations. In 1811, of course, we have an interim. 1809, we have an American Synod. 1810, we have an American Seminary. We now have sort of this standing point in a history where the church can be called American. No longer Scots-Irish, no longer immigrant simply, but now it is uniquely American. In 1812, it faces its first American test. The War of 1812. Which in fact lasted until 1817. But anyway, in the War of 1812, there is a unique problem that is facing America at large. How British are you? You've been a British colony since we beat up the French in the French and Indian War. You've been a British colony until you fought them out of the land in the War for Independence, in the Revolution in the 1700s. But now the British are coming back. See, the British were never eradicated from Canada. The British were never completely eradicated from the northern coast. As a matter of fact, right up until the War of 1812, the forts along the American frontier in New York, that would be along the St. Lawrence Seaway, along the Great Lakes into Ohio, are still manned by British soldiers. Our frontier was still edged by the British Empire. Now, how much of America is American? How much of it is British becomes the question. So the War of 1812, though its political objective, its military objective, was to drive the remaining British troops off the continent and to say, North America is American. Brits go home. That was the final thrust of the War of 1812, to clean up, to finish what was undone in the Revolution. But underneath was this current. Brit or American? What are you? And so at this time, John Adams, actually just previous to this, John Adams has passed a series of laws with lingering influence. They are called the Alien and Sedition Acts. Anything that is pro-British, by the way, these are very unconstitutional. Anything that is pro-British is inherently anti-American. So if you believe, for instance, in the descending obligation of Scottish covenants, you're not American. That's unpatriotic and punishable under the Alien and Sedition Acts. If you believe that America should make a covenant like the Scottish covenants, that's unpatriotic and punishable. The War of 1812 is launched and the Covenanters are in the crosshairs. You sound awfully British. Are you? Or are you American? The Covenanters, based on the American Revolution, already had a pattern for giving in. Already had a pattern for supporting war. And sure enough, Alexander MacLeod, a giant in the age of the American Covenanters, fills his pulpit in New York City and preaches a series of sermons known as the War Sermons. The War Sermons, where Alexander MacLeod preaches participation in the War of 1812, where he argues for a modified oath of office, where we do not have to affirm the atheistic antinomian constitution. Instead, they take a separate vow and serve in the American armies. The
the argument from McLeod boils down to this. The covenant-breaking constitution of Britain is more evil than the atheistic constitution of America. That at least with the American Constitution, there is opportunity to sanctify it and Christianize it. Britain is without hope. This is something of the heart of McLeod's argument, and it will come back in 20 years. Mark it. In 1832, McLeod's war sermons and his argument that the American Constitution has hope for change and Britain has no hope will come back to haunt the church. He preaches these sermons. They serve in the War of 1812. And again, you have that small pebble that may begin an avalanche. And it does 20 years later. At the same time, during the War of 1812 and following into the 1820s, there's debate over serving on juries. There's extended debate. May we serve in juries? May we serve? What part? The question is what part of the political process can we participate in? Can we vote? Can we not vote? Can we serve on juries? Can we not serve on juries? Can we hold office? Can we not hold office? The issue comes down time and time again where the church rules over and over. No, you cannot serve on juries. No, you cannot serve on juries. But as the ruling comes down, there is a shift in the argument. And this is the important notice. That by the late 1820s, the ruling comes down from Synod. Look, no, you can't serve on juries. But the burden of proof shifts. Meaning this, when they first hand down the ruling in 1807, it's, you must prove that serving on juries is legitimate. By the late 1820s, the ruling of Synod is, you must prove that serving on juries is illegitimate. The burden of proof shifts from participation. You have to prove participation is okay. The burden of proof shifts to, you have to prove participation harms. Or in some way destroys. Again, you can feel the sliding impulse. Participating in the War of 1812 is okay if you adjust your oath. Because the American Constitution is less evil than the British government. You cannot serve on juries, but the burden of proof is shifting. You can feel the slide. And this sliding on the issue of dissent comes to a head in 1830. A man named James Renwick Wilson, a hardcore Covenanter. There's a picture of him here around somewhere. He's got it there. James Renwick Wilson, this gruff-looking man here. J.R. Wilson, he's a pastor in Coldenham, New York. Yes, that church comes back again. He's a pastor in Coldenham, New York, and he detects this slide. He detects that the Covenanters are sliding toward the ARP position again. He detects that the conviction on political dissent is weakening. He writes a hard, conservative paper arguing Christ is king in the nation, and so we must not participate in an atheistic and antinomian nation. This paper is presented to Synod. He wants it adopted as a position of the church to shore up the foundation and strengthen the conviction on dissent. The paper is given to a committee to examine and to test. The chairman of the committee is Alexander McLeod, author of the war sermons. McLeod and his committee draft an opposing paper. They draft a paper that disagrees with Wilson's position on dissent. The papers are brought to the floor of Synod. There is dissent, there is disagreement, there is division. They fight it out to no avail. Finally, the motion comes to the floor. Let's open the discussion. Let's print articles and letters for a time in the denominational newspaper. Let's have an open discussion in the denomination. The matter moves to the papers, to the churches, to the congregations and the homes. For two years, they fight it out in the denominational paper. In 1832, Samuel B. Wiley and a small committee of ministers bring
to the Eastern Sub-Synod, so this isn't full synod, it's half synod, brings to the Eastern Sub-Synod a paper in which he argues. This is actually very important. Samuel B. Wiley argues that the mediatorial kingship of Christ over the nations is essential Christian doctrine. You have to believe it. But political dissent as an expression of Christ's kingship is a matter of conscience. He puts political dissent into the arena of the liberty of the conscience, Christian liberty. Samuel B. Wiley's paper is brought to this sub-synod. Sub-synod rules on the paper and says, "We love your paper, except for the part about political dissent. Publish your paper without the section on political dissent being Christian liberty." Samuel Wiley publishes the whole paper. He and his fellow pastors are suspended and disciplined. This is important because when it comes to controversy in the church, this is always the story. Yes, there is theology, but there are men and their egos get in it and their sins get in it. He disobeys the church and friends, Samuel B. Wiley and his pastors are not disciplined for believing that political dissent is liberty of the conscience. They are disciplined for disobeying a court of the church and publishing a document they were told not to publish. Later that year in 1833, the whole National Synod comes together in Philadelphia. And when they gather together, the retiring moderator is one of Samuel B. Wiley's suspended ministers. He takes the pulpit at the front of the church to give the retiring moderator's address. And half of the pastors and elders in synod stand up, walk out, and constitute synod down the street at another RP church. And they meet concurrently. There are two RP synods from that moment on. The guys who get up and go out and go down the street and meet in another RP church become old light. That's their phrase. Old light. They argue that political dissent is essential to the covenanter identity. The new lights say, no, it is liberty of the conscience. Alexander McLeod and Samuel B. Wiley lead the new light movement. And the old light is led by J.R. Wilson. And these two divide old light, new light. Liberty of the conscience, essential doctrine. It's at this point in 1834 when the excommunication between them, I don't mean that in the official church discipline sense, I mean that in the division between the churches formalized in 1834, the old lights under J.R. Wilson make political dissent a vow for church membership. Until 1834, it was not required for membership. It becomes required for membership in 1834. They divide over dissent. This is not the last time the American Covenanters continue to struggle with this question. In 1890, several pastors in the Pittsburgh Presbytery bring a statement to their presbytery in which they say, it is not essential for membership to hold to political dissent. They say that the heart of membership in the church is belief in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And if someone will publicly affirm the Word of God, the triune God, faith in Jesus Christ, then we will welcome them into membership no matter their position on political dissent. They basically adopt Wiley's position and argue it's liberty of the conscience. The Pittsburgh Presbytery disciplines them, and in 1891, Synod upholds Presbytery's discipline. It's called the East End Controversy because there was an East End RP church where these men met to form their document. The East End Controversy divided the church again. The RP church in the 1890s was in its heyday. It was the biggest it's ever been, 11,000 people strong. We're about 6,500 right now. We are half the strength we were in the 1890s. In the 1950s, 40s, we were about 3,000.
We have doubled. We have grown. But this rocked the church to its core. By the end of the decade, the turn of the century, by 1900, the RP Church was in a free fall. They had lost many members and pastors to the East End controversy, to political dissents, convictions. And by 1900, they were in a free fall. For half a century, their membership would decline. Synod finally ruled in an interesting way in 1967. It's hard to talk about this when there's living memory in the room. In 1967, political dissent was ruled to be a matter of conscience. Samuel B. Wiley's position was adopted by the RP Church. Are you with me? The position that political dissent is liberty of the conscience was the New Light position. It was what the division was over. It was the East End position. It's what the division was over. And in 1967, the last of the Covenanters, I probably shouldn't say it that way, but the Covenanter Church adopted the position of the East End and New Light Covenanters. This is the American Covenanters' folkway and story. They struggle and they strive over political dissent. What is our place in America? What do we do and how do we do it? They fight and they wonder, they divide, and they change. To this day, the debate is not dead. The debate is alive in the Covenanter Church. But the American Covenanters are not just the story of political dissent. It's bigger than that. There is this social and systemic sins that they fight. I mean by this, there are sins in the American culture that are ingrained, almost inherent for a time. And the American Covenanters had a particular passion for social and systemic sins. The first one is slavery. The story begins with Alexander MacLeod. Yes, that Alexander MacLeod who wrote the war sermons. In year 1800, 2 years after Coldenham RP Church was formed in 1798, Coldenham is looking for a pastor. They call young Alexander MacLeod. I can't resist. He was actually called by two churches, New York City and Coldenham. New York City and Coldenham today are an hour and a half apart. He had joint pastoral ministry in New York City and Coldenham. They're an hour and a half apart by car. This guy's nuts. He took the call. He'd served these two churches. But first, there was a change that needed to be made. In Coldenham RP Church, some members of the church owned slaves. There is, in fact, a balcony, a second-story balcony, in the back half of the congregation that is now a nursery with a glass where you can watch and hear the worship service while your children cry quietly behind the glass. That balcony was not for children. It was for slaves, where they could sit up in the back away from the white congregation. Alexander MacLeod said, "I will go to Coldenham on one condition." As a matter of fact, he turned down the call at first. "Until the slaves are set free, I will not be their pastor." In 1801, the slaves are set free. He becomes their pastor. And in the same time, the RPCNA becomes the first organized denomination, second religious group, to condemn slavery and ban it among its membership. The Mennonites had done it earlier, but they're not an organized coalesced denomination. As a religious body, the Mennonites had condemned slavery and forbidden it. The RPs were second, the first of the official denominations to ban slavery among their membership. But opposition to slavery wasn't limited to Alexander MacLeod or votes in presbytery. In fact, they voted with their feet. Do you remember the three presbyteries formed in 1809? North, Vermont and New York. Middle, Pennsylvania. South, South Carolina. Throughout the 1820s and 1830s, the South Carolina RPs, how many of you here are from Indiana? Yeah, the South Carolina RPs throughout the 1820s and 30s moved to Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, and even northern New York. They would not stay where slavery was the norm. In fact, this pattern is overwhelming. By 1819, there's a Pittsburgh Presbytery. In the 1820s, there is a Western Presbytery. There is an Ohio Presbytery, an Illinois Presbytery, an Indiana, Michigan Presbytery, a New York Presbytery. These presbyteries are formed in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s out of South Carolina Covenanters fleeing from slavery. The Southern Presbytery is closed in 1840. There are no Covenanters of the RPCNA left in the South. They've left over slavery. They moved and voted with their feet. They also participated with their homes and their hospitality. Covenanting pastors, their houses were stops on the Underground Railroad. Geneva College, when it was in Northwood, Ohio, was a stop on the Underground Railroad. This is one of my favorites. You want a picture for the kind of church you're a member of? The U.S. Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act and said, when you find a fugitive slave, you are required by law to return him to the South or her. The RPCNA that year met in synod, and they passed a resolution in which they stated, if you obey the Fugitive Slave Act, you are liable to church discipline. The RPCNA required disobedience to the Fugitive Slave Act. They required participation in the Underground Railroad. That's the church you're a part of. Man, they believe Jesus is King and they don't care about the cost. This is an expensive decision. Guys, this is not a private hush-hush. We're part of the Underground Railroad. This is a published decision by a church. It's not like Congress isn't going to find out. But they do it anyway. They pass a resolution and declare, this act is sinful. Slavery is abhorrent, and RPs, covenanters, must disobey. This is their fighting. They fight slavery. It is aggressive. It is expensive. They fight alcohol. This is something that grows throughout the 19th century. At first, it was the recommending that they the cessation of trade. This is confusing to Americans in the 21st century. The first proposition that the RPs had was, that the Covenanters had was, stop the sale and the trade of alcohol. They didn't forbid the consumption of alcohol. They didn't forbid the use of alcohol, but the sale and the trade of alcohol. We all sit there and go, what's going on there? You're living in a time where it was very common to make your own alcohol. And so the implication of the RP position is, make your own alcohol for medicinal use. But don't buy or sell. The only reason to mass produce alcohol is for drunkenness. The RP said, you can make it in small home-based quantities for medicine, but don't mass produce it and sell it. This was their first position. As time went on, and it's unique, the statistics that have been done, they end up urging total abstinence. Notice the word urging, not requiring. Urging total abstinence as time goes on. This is about the 1850s. Drunkenness in America by the 1850s is becoming an epidemic. The RP position on alcohol directly responds to the prevalence of alcohol in American society. Alcohol is expensive and mostly made at home in the 1820s and 30s. And so they recommend, don't buy it from a store, make it at home. You can't get drunk with what you make. You don't make enough. But then it moves to total abstinence as the trade of alcohol grows. The exception that's given, however, is for the Lord's Supper and again for medicine. The RP Synod rules, you can use alcohol for medicine or the Lord's Supper. Finally, last of all, they confirm in the most authoritative way in the 1870s, complete abstinence. At that point, they also jump into the support of the 18th Amendment and the encouragement of prohibition. Complete illegal, making the liquor trade, consumption, sale, any of it completely illegal.
Again, over time, I'll skip through this, the debates and the discussions of the 20th century. There was much, much discussion over this in the 20th century. Finally, in 1998, Synod removed Vow 8 from the Vow of Ordination, granting the last piece of the RP Church that alcohol is a matter of conscience. I want you to see something. Under this Folkway, I'm focusing on their fight against social sin. One is slavery, one is drunkenness. They fight against these social sins violently, aggressively, loudly. But I also want you to notice another developing Folkway among American Covenanters. Political dissent was the hallmark of RPs in the 19th century, the 1800s. What was a Covenanter, publicly speaking? Political dissent. It became liberty of the conscience in 1967. And then in the 20th century, what was the hallmark, the public manifestation of the Covenanter? Prohibition, opposition to alcohol. But in 1998, it becomes a matter of the conscience. Do you see a trend? Two things that were required for membership in the church are now liberty of the conscience. This is an enormous shift. These two things were required for membership in one day. Today they are ruled by Synod to be liberty of the conscience. These are big shifts, big changes. One other Folkway, they wrestle and struggle with political dissent, concluding its liberty of the conscience. They wrestle with slavery, fighting it viciously. They wrestle with drunkenness and alcohol, ending up ruling its liberty of conscience. But then there's something else RPs do, and this is uniquely American. They institutionalize. They form an institutionalized denomination. Throughout the history of the church, outside of America, it is very uncommon for churches to own institutions. And yet we have several. And this is striking. RPTS, of course, seminary founded in 1810. It was a portable seminary. It belonged to the man. The professor at 1 Samuel B. Wiley was the professor, and it met with him in his home. J.R. Wilson ended up becoming the professor for the time. It met with him in his home. It was a portable seminary. It was with him in Coldenham when he was there. It was with him in Albany when he was there. While he was in Coldenham, Thomas Sproul, a pastor in Pittsburgh, had a seminary there. There was actually two RPTSs at one time. One in Pittsburgh with Thomas Sproul, one in Coldenham with J.R. Wilson. The RPTS then moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, again with J.R. Wilson. Finally, it settled in Pittsburgh and became an institution. It owned a building in the Mexican War streets for some 50, 60 years. Well, actually, it was nearly 100 years, now that I think about it. But then they ended up buying the Horn Mansion over near Wilkinsburg in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. They ended up becoming accredited by ATS in the 1970s, I believe, under the work of Bruce Stewart. It becomes a national institution. What started out in 1810 as a pastor being picked as the pastor to train future pastors, that's the seminary in the 1800s. This is the guy who trains future pastors. That's what the seminary is. It becomes a building with faculty and staff and phone lines and, you know, wireless internet. And it becomes something with endowments and institutional funds and something with accreditation. It institutionalizes and yet is under the authority and oversight of the church. Geneva College, 1848 in Northwood, Ohio. It is formed with the vision, not its present day vision, its original vision was to be a stepping stone to RPTS. What they realized is these young pastors or young men who wanted to be pastors didn't have basic educational requirements. Education was in rough shape in America at this time. So they formed Geneva College to lay the liberal art, the worldview foundation that was needed for men to go to RPTS. It moved to Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania in 1880. There they built an enormous stone structure at great cost, and they went massively in debt, and they went way over schedule, and it's called Old Main. That building
cost the RP church gobs of money and lots of time. But it institutionalized. It now had a building. It now had endowment. It now has faculty and staff. And it is still run in different degrees by the RP church. These things, by the way, RPTS and Geneva College have outgrown the RP church. Geneva College is operating budgets like $34 million. Geneva, you know, RP contribution, our synod's contribution to them is about $50,000. They blink and they don't notice it. That's like 1 year's tuition for one student. It's unbelievable how big these things have grown, and yet they are managed by the RP church. The RP home in 1896, there was a grant given to provide a home. Here's the problem. You have missionaries and you have pastors, and they're not paid very much. And then they get really old and they can't be missionaries and pastors anymore. They don't have retirement. They don't have Social Security. They don't have a way to live. They depend on families. But very often what happens with a pastor and a missionary? Their children become pastors and missionaries. So they don't have very much to give to their aging parents. And so this group of women in Pittsburgh gather these funds, these endowments, to start a home for aging and retired pastors and missionaries. They come to the Synod in 1896 and ask for Synod support. Synod essentially says, well, we'll give you a committee. They don't actually endorse it. In 1897, the Reformed Presbyterian Women's Association is formed. This is, in a sense, in lieu of Synod oversight. This association will run the RP home in the absence of Synod. It is the RP home. It is not under the oversight of Synod. It is not under the authority structures of the church. It is an independent organization. But since 1897, it has been home for many RP churches, many RP pastors and missionaries. There is also then these institutions that have gotten huge and they're bigger than the church itself. And yet the church gives to them and ministers to them and even oversees them. But last, there's also then this institutionalized denominationalism that we become this structure, we become this institution. It's the rise of the distinctives and the testimony. For most of the RP church's history, you became an RP by complete subscription to the Westminster Confession of Faith, its catechisms, its directory of worship. You are not required complete subscription anymore. You are required submission in the Lord. That's vow 5, I think, in the covenant of communicant membership. Submission in the Lord. They also then write the testimony. And the testimony is an update of Westminster Confession to deal with present day issues. But it is also a point where they disagree with Westminster. The RP church as a denomination ceased to hold to complete subscription to Westminster. The denomination itself said, we do not subscribe to everything in Westminster. We have points of disagreement. This then divorces them from the Scottish roots, from the Westminster Confession. This creates a uniquely American confession. We call it the testimony. It is a merge. It is utterly dependent on Westminster. It is an organic growth of Westminster, but it is an entirely and uniquely American set of convictions. These distinctives arise and they form the identity of an American denomination. That's my thesis. Okay, so the fulcrum that's developing is a uniquely American institution. We have a seminary, a college, a home, and a confession that is all our own. Nobody else has it. The other parts of the American things, I'll have to move quickly through these. The American folkways, there's optimism that dominates the American covenanters. Post-millennialism comes to the fore. Christ is coming back. The world must be converted for His return. Not only converted, that's premillennialism simply, but it must in fact become under the reign and rule of Christ. His law reigns supreme. Post-millennialism dominates in the 19th and early 20th century. It leads to massive global and home missions. I can't cover this without stepping on John McFarland's toes. You'll hear about it on Thursday. There's mission to the Chinese immigrants in San Francisco. There's missions to the Native Americans in Cache Creek, Oklahoma. There's mission to the freed slaves in Selma, Alabama. Some of these places still have RP churches. There's a mission to Syria. There's a mission to Cyprus. There's a mission to China, Manchuria, Japan, even Haiti for a time. This little tiny church that was never bigger than 11,000 members ran a seminary, a home, they ran a college, and they had global and home missions on that level because they didn't do anything else. That's what they did. The American Covenanters, like the immigrant and Scottish Covenanters, were sold out to the work of the church and were convinced that this deserved all their time and money. I need to hit this one. These Covenanters formed then an American covenant. Two, in fact. From 1807 to 1870, 63 years, the American Covenanters tried to make an American covenant. They tried and they tried and they couldn't do it. They tried and they tried and they couldn't do it. In 1870, Synod finally approved a covenant. Finally. In 1871, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 1871, they affirmed the covenant. It is in your book, the spiral-bound life-focused booklet that was handed out, has page 47 and following, has the 1871 covenant that was affirmed in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A second brief covenant, it was called the Short Covenant or the Brief Covenant, was in 1954 in Grinnell, Iowa. There they affirmed a second covenant. These are uniquely American covenants. The point at this is, at this juncture, we have then an American institution with American institutions under it. We have an American vision of missions, an American vision of eschatology, an American fight against American sins, and a struggle from the beginning with our place in the American environment. So then you know where I'm going. They failed. They failed. Humanly speaking, you cannot look into this world and see this great and amazing RP church with their folkways thriving. But their folkways live on. And their folkways are here. We fight social and systemic sins with the vigor that they fought. We don't fight the same ones. But again, have you seen RPs fight abortion? Social and systemic sin. Maybe we don't fight to the level they did, but maybe we should. It's our inherited folkway to look at social sins and to say we will not turn a blind eye. We will fight, no matter how futile. We still struggle over our place in the political process. The question of dissent, this folkway lives on. We still go to RPTS and Geneva College. I went to both. I live in these folkways, and I have inherited them. I know of the optimism in the mission. I am pastor of a church plant in Enid, Oklahoma. I have been to the gravestones of McFarlands, who worshipped in Oklahoma centuries before I came. I've been there. I have pictures. They're just gravestones. But they're folkways I've inherited. They're ways of living and believing that we share. Their folkways live on. I want one last folkway here, guys. This one's a big one for me. Do we covenant? Have you taken vows for communicant membership? What is it called? The covenant of communicant membership. We are still covenanters. Do we need a national covenant? You betcha. Do we need big social change for a national covenant? You betcha. But do the covenanters still take covenants? Every Sunday that we have the Lord's Supper,
that we receive a new member, that we baptize a new member. We take covenants.
They are covenants. We are covenanters. You took vows. I took vows.
And we are in covenant, you and I. That's our folk way that we've inherited. Let's pray. Our Father in heaven, we again praise you for our fathers who have taught us the sins to avoid, the righteousness to seek, the Jesus to desperately yearn for. Father, I thank you that we live in an American world that tries and tests our faith and teaches us to run to Jesus and to depend on Him. Father, fill our hearts with a zealous and insatiable passion for the glory of Jesus Christ here in this land, that we too, Father, might be covenanters who zealously seek the glory of Jesus Christ. For this we pray in His name. Amen.